Oh, boy, that's tricky. All right. Ron, are you still up? Are you eating?
No, I'm not eating. Are we on the Community Stewardship Fund or are we on the vehicular road access easement?
I think we agreed that we had covered the road access easement question, other than the question that Steve Schaefer had regarding the timing. We did a search of the easement, I think, at lunchtime. Evan, did you find
yes,
anything?
Yes, the wording in the easement says at all reasonable times.
And I had a question regarding whether or not this was, we were sure that ATVs were included in things that were allowed on the road, and the easement again did say recreational vehicular access. So however you interpret that, I guess gets you there.
I think as a matter of law, ATVs aren't allowed on the road, but
not allowed on public roads.
And the landowner has the right to post private roads for no ATV usage as well.
That was why the question as to whether this easement included ATVs or not. Mm. And I guess it's still open to interpretation.
I would not think that we would want to require that they be open to ATV use, because the landowner is responsible for their, if there are any environmental consequences, we hold them responsible, not the user. So I think that we have to, if we're going to hold them responsible for any damage, they have to have the right to decide who gets to use their roads for what purpose.
Well, the other issue is safety, pulp trucks and ATVs.
Right. We have what, Jim?
Clarity on the, where is the ATV access trails, if any? It doesn't seem to be clear.
We will find out. I understand the issue, and we will have to talk to BPL as to how they are reading this and the degree to which this needs to be all clarified.
Okay. Thank you.
Pardon me? Yes. Please go ahead.
Well, I'm happy to answer any questions. I'm not sure.
Ron, you broke a, I mean, you made a fairly significant departure here from what was discussed. I mean, in the idea of breaking this fund up three different ways and the administration of it, you might want to just offer us a brief rationale for that.
Sure. There were two purposes for what staff consultants were recommending. I think the jumping off point of this is on page 115, note 104. Plum Creek's plan description states that Plum Creek recognizes that there are social, educational, recreational, and community needs in the region that are not funded or are not adequately funded by taxes, fees, charities, and other revenue sources. Therefore, Plum Creek will establish a Moosehead Regional Community Stewardship Fund to help address these needs. Staff consultants, point number one, staff consultants believe that the three needs listed here are the only three that meet the, from record evidence, are the only three that meet the twin requirements of related to regulatory criteria, CLUP goals, et cetera, and are testified to as needs in the record. So, for example, the Affordable Housing Fund is the only one in which there's real record evidence as to social, educational, recreational, community needs in terms of public infrastructure or quasi-public infrastructure needs. Recreation, we've talked a lot about. There was record evidence of, in fact, Plum Creek witnesses who were talking about certain wildlife mitigation for loons, for invasive species that they were recommending or the agencies were, but there was no provision in any funding of providing that. So one is one purpose is that type of connection. The second is that from an organizational implementation point of view, our humble judgment is that what was being proposed was an organizational nightmare in which you would have a nonprofit that had very ambiguous, very open-ended charge, membership that was unclear how it would get there, and we saw the potential for substantial disagreement, gridlock, so that nothing was accomplished. So to the extent that you agree that you want an organizational structure that works, then the question is, well, for what should it work? And our recommendation is that it should work for these three purposes for which there's record evidence in support. There's some sub, but that's the basic answer, Mr. Chairman. And then the question becomes, if you agree with that, and I'm not saying you do, but just to give you a sense of our thinking proceeding from there, the question then becomes tying down the specific purposes. Recreation is a pretty broad category. How much money and to whom should it go? I think that's it. Taking them one by one, on the Moosehead Recreation Fund, there was a lot of discussion in the record of the need for or the desire for some kind of broad-scale recreation management of the area. We didn't think that was going to work. There was a lot of, when that discussion came up, there was a lot of comparison to areas that had public ownership and management plans for recreation and how those management plans would be changed and everything. And that may work just dandy in a public forest in a national park, but in a situation here where you would have a private landowner whose charge was not recreation management, and maybe any number of private landowners, we couldn't really see how a unified recreation management plan was going to work, where the enforcement would be, where the authority would be, nor did we think the record evidence, in our view, supported the need for that kind of recreation management. What we did think the record supported very clearly is the specific areas where we are suggesting the recreation, the Moosehead Recreation Fund go towards hiking, biking trails, related needs, signage, trailheads, et cetera, BPL-operated campsites and campgrounds. There was a lot of testimony and a lot of commission concern on that issue, and public boat launches, all in the concept plan area. And then we tried to provide, and this can be obviously changed or refined at your wishes, who should be making these decisions with some mix of state recreational interests and local recreational interests, and the landowner deciding that. So that was, without going on, the rationale, and I'll save the funding allocation suggestion. On the Affordable Housing Fund, I think...
Before you leave that, could you, are you suggesting that a committee be formed to manage that piece of the fund?
What we're saying is that it's administered by BPL, administered with a small a.
The fund goes to BPL.
The fund would go to BPL and would be governed by a board made up of...
Oh, okay, two
representatives.
All right, all right.
Yeah.
Is there any reason why you left out Beaver Cove, or would there be a reason to include them on your list there of representatives for the board?
I'm Evan, just... do you want to comment on that?
Tried to make sure that communities that have recreational services and infrastructure and could be impacted by the new demands were represented. I'm not aware that Beaver Cove has those infrastructure facilities. That doesn't mean they shouldn't be there,
right.
But...
I haven't given a lot of thought to this. It was just a sort of a reaction, just because they sort of represent the other side of the lake, you know, the east side of the lake, or some... Otherwise, you don't have...
Sure.
Just a thought.
Good point.
In terms of the governing structure that you set forth, it occurs to me that the same issue with regard to landowner representation, here it specifically designates Plum Creek, but obviously that may change into the future. And again, as you pointed out, if the land is disaggregated, you may end up with a number of landowners, and therefore there'd be very substantial representation of landowners on this governing board. I'm not sure that's necessarily bad, but I just raised that for your comment.
Well, if your desire is to limit that to one landowner, we can certainly put that in the recommendation and then see the kind of comment.
Well, I'd like to think that through.
Yeah. Okay.
Or alternatively, what may be a solution to that is come up with a fractional approach where should there be more than one landowner in the future, they get, right. You know, a quarter vote per
winner. I think we want to make sure that landowners' voices are heard.
Absolutely.
But the extent to which they, by the way we constitute this governing mechanism, should sort of legally dominate, I think, depends on the authority that's being accorded them and what's the sort of the purpose of the governing body.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think we all have to keep in mind that it's highly likely that the trails and the trailheads and the parking areas are all going to be in balance or legacy easement lands, and working together as to how those should be sited and everything else is going to be critical.
Another approach, just for interest's sake, might be to create a fund that was a grant-giving fund where towns, governments, or trails groups or boating groups or whatever could apply for grants to do different projects. And then you'd have this committee that would meet to decide the grants.
Okay.
I think that's a great idea, but I'd like to present that as an option, not as sort of the exclusive mechanism for the dispensation of these monies. I mean, it just seems to me that that there are responsibilities under the easement that need to be met, again, in order to meet our regulatory requirements to mitigate for adverse impacts. And I think we need to be assured somehow that the expenditures from these funds are related to that in some sense. That'd be my
own. I hear that. The other thing, Commissioner White, that I was thinking of is that, and there can be comments on this in 30 days, but it wouldn't surprise me if Plum Creek strongly wanted to limit how many parties they were dealing with who might be operating trails and campgrounds and ever in the easement lands, and that's why our recommendation was it's BPL. Now, BPL could subcontract that out, I suppose, with some kind of permission, but in the same way that it's very important in the forestry going forward to have as much of a collaborative relationship as can occur, I think having BPL as the people who are going to figure out campsites and having Plum Creek having one person or one entity to go to and say that campsite's a mess, you're not monitoring it, it's causing us all kinds of trouble, clean up your act.
No, I understand that, but I got the sense from the hearings at least that people had been given to understand that no matter what they wanted, they could get it from the community fund, and so right. Everybody was hoping to tap the community fund for something. So it's fine, you know, BPL administers it, but I think there's a presumption on the part of the community in the Greenville area that they'll see some benefit from this,
well,
not only on the easement lands, but perhaps
no, I
in
couldn't
town.
Agree with you more that there was You know, it's Christmas in May for everybody, and we're specifically recommending against that because we think it'll lead to not getting some things accomplished that are related to this proceeding and that could be accomplished.
Okay, do you feel then that the purpose of the Community Stewardship Fund is to put recreational facilities, in this case, on the easement land specifically?
Well, good question. First of all, we don't think there should be a Community Stewardship Fund anymore. We think there should be three funds created per page 115, with the first one being Moosehead Recreation Fund that has important but narrow purposes.
Okay.
And whether those purposes are fulfilled, a boat ramp that might supplement what Greenville has right now would be fine. But so it wouldn't necessarily have to be on the easement lands, and it would be up to this group of people to determine the best use of that money. Mm-hmm. That's what we're recommending that.
Yeah, I just thought that some of it had to do with compensation for pain and suffering or something, or calming down the natives or whatever it was. But it sounds like you're going in the right direction.
Yeah, and those are your words, not mine, or Steph's. both parts of your sentence.
Steve has a way of stirring the pot occasionally, Ron, as you know.
I think we discussed the Affordable Housing Fund yesterday. Happy to answer any questions. I think we...
But I think I've been shut off. There's part of this is going to become an affordable housing fund, but there's also later on in this section, there's talk about a CEI grant and then a follow-on CEI.
How would those work together?
Yeah,
that's a good question. Let me explain my understanding. The state of the world for affordable housing, as the record reflects, is that fortunately or unfortunately, you've got to pull together another number of subsidies to make it work. One subsidy is the cost of land, which is being donated up to 100 acres by Plum Creek. One of it is a subsidy for the subsidized loan itself, or some cheaper money, so to speak. But both CEI, in Mike Finnegan's testimony, and the Maine State Housing Authority were very clear that on any particular project, particularly rental unit, multifamily rental unit property, that additional subsidies are going to have to be there to really make it work. I mean, that doesn't mean there isn't one project that couldn't, but generally that additional subsidies are going to have to be there. So what this would be proposed, and Maine State Housing Authority, through various subsidies that apparently are not as available as they once were, generally provides those subsidies or is quite involved in providing certain subsidies, pass-through money from the federal government, et cetera, in particular projects. So the notion here is that, and I don't think we're talking about, we ran some very rough assumption-based numbers, but the idea is the Maine State Housing Authority would administer this money, as it does other subsidies, to worthy projects, which could very much be sponsored by CEI. And I don't have any sense that it wouldn't work together very well. Whether it's sufficient or not is quite an open question. The last piece, sir, Mr. Chair, is the funding allocation. 45-45-10. There's no magic here. It's really a reflection of what we think the record supports in relative funding demands that would be required. We have record evidence that a mile of trail costs $15,000 a mile to build. The subsidies that would be required for affordable housing are quite significant, whereas for very pretty modest dollars, A lot of it related to constructing loons' nests or written education material, some monitoring. Commissioner Kurtz may be able to fill in a lot of the details of this, that the wildlife and invasives is potentially of a lesser magnitude. But I want to hasten to say that the record on this issue, too, was not as matured or ripe as we want it. And so I think comment on whether this allocation makes sense or whether we're way off base would be appropriate.
Also, it raises the perpetuity issue again, in that this allocation may make sense in terms of today's perceived needs. But as some of those needs are met, some of them may be ongoing, some of them may be met, there may be new needs arise, and I would assume then that that would require an amendment to the concept plan. Again, might argue for some kind of, in instances where these amendments are relatively non-controversial and for which there is general consensus, if we could have a facilitated amendment process that would not unduly burden sort of the progressive evolution of this fund.
Right. I understand. I mean, part of this is going to be driven by a limited and probably tapering amount of money, because
that's true.
You'll remember that the initial slug of money, which is 2%, comes with initial lot sales.
Right.
And after those initial lot sales are done, it's half a percentage on resale. It's very difficult to know whether those resales are going to occur every 3 years, every 7 years, as I guess we understand to be some broad average or more. So I don't think we're talking here about millions of dollars that will be floating around in lots of years on this one.
Good point.
We also talked yesterday about whether or not the 2% would be applied to single-family home units at resorts.
Right. And we can put that up again. If there are not questions on that, there's one other funding provision that I want to draw your attention to when you're ready.
Ron, on what you just handed out, the last, on the right-hand column, number two there, the long-term plan demonstrates that the resort and these units will not contribute to the needs that these three funds are addressing. I just read through this quickly. But
right. What does that mean?
You want to yes. Know? That's my question.
Well, here's a for instance. Let's say a resort at Big Moose within the zone and at the resort owner's resort developer's expense, because they see it as amenities, provides an extensive network of hiking trails that might also be open to the public. I mean, I think there's a fair argument that says we've paid our dues on this, thank you very much. And that argument, you know, could be made. Similarly, wildlife continue, and this is just very conceptual, okay? But there's been a lot of discussion in the record of how resorts, and the applicant intends, for instance, intends, there's not a mechanism, on wildlife mitigation, invasive species. You could see a situation where for many, many units, they have a program in place that for all the resort-owned units where people, and they come in, are given materials on invasive species control if they have their boats. There's, you know, I'm being exaggerating here just to make the point that they're all required to go through a five-minute video on safe boating and cleaning your boat, et cetera, where an argument can be made that because of this controlled nature of a resort, that they're really doing their part. I'm not saying it will, but I think we have to acknowledge that possibility and not saying automatic, because as opposed to 55 individual landowners at Long Pond who aren't part of a legal and financial structure that's building as part of a resort fee that they may have to pay equivalent to a condominium fee, you know, the 55 individual landowners at Long Pond may not be contributing to a pool of money that does all these things. And if there are, that should at least be open for discussion, but it would have to be vetted pretty carefully in the long-term plan. That's the only point we're making.
I understand that, but it might the reverse be the case also. I mean, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. I mean, if it were determined by BPL that the, or by LURC, that the nature of the development was such that it imposed in additional
absolutely
impacts, that then an additional assessment could be undertaken?
Well, I'm not sure I would go that far as terms.
Well, you're talking about reducing the assessment.
You're talking about either not having one or imposing it as it's proposed here, the 2% rule.
Right, but what I'm saying is, you're saying that if we find, or the commission finds, that these conditions have been met, then the assessment doesn't apply, correct? If we determined that the nature of the resort or the subdivision was such that it would impose additional burdens in that regard, should there be a mechanism to allow for an additional assessment? I mean, I'm just doing this logically.
Seems to me it's an impact fee, and you use it for purposes stated. If it's not needed for invasive plants, then you use it for lynx habitat, whatever.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if we want to get into that, adjusting these.
No.
Up or down?
Well, I guess...
Yeah.
Well, it says here that this, just to be fair to everybody that's listening to us, we were given a new page for our book that dealt strictly with funding of CSF activities, and it basically clarified the definition of residential dwelling units as being what Plum Creek proposal had to charge 2% of the sale of residential dwelling units. And then it added some language on how to deal with resort accommodation units that are individually owned, basically saying that we would apply the same funding mechanism to those units unless the long-term development plans for the resort proposal, the long-term development plan for the resort proposes and the commission approves.
This page
alternative
reflects
plan.
An omission that I believe staff identified yesterday morning at the outset.
It's more than the omission. That's my, I guess, one of my concerns. This is brand new. The omission that was read to us and that we reflected in our changes that we made ourselves dealt only with the extension of that assessment fee to resort units that were not dedicated to temporary occupancy. This now,
no,
not
this
only...
This is the same thing you saw yesterday.
But you're absolutely
this language right here,
it's not in your packet.
That's
just the same as yesterday. I'm sorry, I was just misunderstanding you. It is new. It was read yesterday but presented to you today.
Do we have copies for the parties?
We can make copies for the parties.
The only thing...
I'd like to think about it, I guess.
Yeah, I understand. And the only thing I would say is, and Aga just pointed this out to me, that I, when any development proposal in a resort is approved, you're going to have to find no undue adverse impact on recreation and wildlife. So that's a starting point. You're going to be approving a long-term development plan where they're going to have to make certain showings of recreation use within the resort, et cetera, et cetera. So I think leaving this open the other way, there are some safeguards to the issues that you're raising at the front end, and leaving this open with an unknown fee that could be assessed may be an issue.
Well, let me tell you what my point is. That's the first time I've seen this language.
I understand, and I apologize.
And what I would, no, no, I, yeah. I, you know, we need to do this organically, and it needs to evolve. What I'm saying is that just having seen this, I can neither endorse this nor object to it. I need to think about it.
Okay.
So if we get to the point of deciding what we're going to send out to comment, I suppose send it out to comment, but... I mean, I can't.
Yeah, I take your point. And okay. If everything were perfect, you would have had it Tuesday night on the internet.
Right, I know.
Can I jump in on the formulation of 45%, 45%, 10%? Mm-hmm. I think my initial reaction is that probably it's based on the record and the analysis of the staff and consultants, and I'm pretty comfortable with that. But I think what I want to point out is that at this point, as I understand it, there are not any invasive plants in the project area, nor are there invasive zebra mussels or any of those other species, although I do understand there's bass. And at the prevention level, you know, the costs of prevention are actually quite small relative to the cost of treating any invasive species. And so I would like to see built in. And I'm not sure Ed was talking about a facilitative amendment. I'm wondering if the language could be written up front rather than requiring an amendment, that the formula can be changed, or that the somehow you're not left with a slush fund, but you're left with a fund. One of the funds is overfunded and one of the others is underfunded, and it takes months to rectify that. I think particularly with invasive species, the sooner you get on the stick to address them, the easier it is to try to mitigate or minimize their impact. So
yeah,
I'm wondering about legally, maybe Jerry can jump in on it, but having that flexibility to deal with something if there actually is an infestation rather than just simply a prevention effort.
I take your point. I think the issue that we'll face, and it may require re-aggregating these functions, is that our recommendation, and we hadn't thought of the issues that you and Commissioner Laverty are raising, which is, you know, why this kind of commissioner involvement is so critical. But if you have three separate funds with fixed monies, how they get repooled is a little tricky. So it may be that this gets put back together with three specific purposes and something else. And it may be, the only thing I would caution is that you not overstructure this, given the amount of money that, you know, our guess is going to be involved in it. And it's just a guess that, you know, we're not talking about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation here. We may be talking, it's all based on approximations. We can give you our very hypothetical, but we may be talking a couple $100,000 a year for when the 2% is, and then some resale value. So, but I take your point, and we can think about it, you know, certainly. Or there can be comments on that in the 30-day period. I did want to raise another funding issue, just to note it. On page 116, in a filing made by Plum Creek. They have entered into a proposed arrangement with Florida Power and Light in terms of allocating allocating financial responsibilities for meeting additional recreation infrastructure needs that may be created as a result of the developments that FPL now bears. And essentially, simplifying it, and I think doing it justice, it says that Plum Creek will pick up those additional recreational costs for an expanded boat launch or a secondary boat launch, things like that, that may be caused by this development. They then are proposing that the Community Stewardship Fund pay for that. There is no limit proposed for those obligations. And we are proposing that gets stripped out because, not necessarily because no money should be provided to that, although I think an argument can be made that this is one of the costs of development, but because it's a completely open-ended obligation that, on the one hand, you could hypothesize in any one year could take a significant chunk of money that would otherwise be available, and if we just don't know. So I just wanted to draw that to your attention. And I think there are two issues the commission would be dealing with there. One, is this a cost of development and therefore not appropriate for the Community Stewardship Fund? Or if it could be argued that the Community Stewardship Fund should play a role in it because it goes to increased recreational use for everyone, and it's really no different in some ways than what we're proposing for the recreation fund, whether you want to put any kind of limits on that so that, $5,000 a year or something like that, if that's where you want to go. So I just wanted to draw that to your attention.
Any other questions on the
that's
fund?
That's the end of the fund.
Oh, yeah. Catherine's passing out, I guess, copies of what we just got, so if you're interested in one. All right. Land donations to BPL for certain public uses, I guess.
Right. This was a formatting error. It's not part of the Community Stewardship Fund. Plum Creek is proposing to donate up to 50 acres to BPL. And then we make a specific suggestion how that 50 acres would be used that we think is consistent with everything we've been talking about. And this isn't meant in any way to limit that. You know, I think there could be an arrangement where Plum Creek would be allowed to sell additional acreage to BPL for these purposes in the easement, consistent with conservation values, but it's simply identifying how this money would be used. So I think that's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
And
okay.
BPL can comment on that if there's any problems.
Are you going to, would you put explicitly write that in that recommendation then, Ron? It's not there, right?
The sale issue?
Yeah.
Sure.
Affordable housing, did we cover that, Steve, enough? Or is there anything, Ron, you want to add to what?
You may have further comments, but I think we've talked about that through mm-hmm. the colloquy you had yesterday and then further mm-hmm. today.
Okay. Concept plan, governing plan amendments. Ability to amend the concept plan. I guess we've had a fair amount of discussion about that already. I don't know. Are you comfortable at this point that you have what our thoughts are on that? Or is the commission comfortable that they've imparted all the thoughts on that?
I don't know, as we've talked about how we were going to amend it. We talked several times about places where it might need to be amended.
Yeah, this plan amendment section is really looking at the issue more holistically. I've heard dialogue about the issue of plan amendment in the context of the Roaches property, which I think we have gotten some feedback on. As, however, with respect to the development areas within the plan, and we've also discussed at length the plan amendment provisions within the easements, or the amendment provisions within the easements, excuse me. This section on page 120 is really addressing our views of how the commission should approach concept plan amendments as a whole, including amendments to the development side of the equation.
Amendments following the sale of the lot, as I recall that discussion, we got into what potentially was an extremely convoluted process. Is it your recommendation here that you basically saying that we should not allow Plum Creek to distribute that out to some kind of superhuman effort and association?
No, we're not making that recommendation.
Okay,
Plum Creek, on page 119, we summarize our understanding of several approaches that Plum Creek has proposed with respect to the plan amendment issues here. And basically what our recommendation is with respect to plan amendment, aside from the Roaches property, which because of this we are recommending be pulled out of the PRP subdistrict, is that the commission should understand that plan amendment will be very a LURC initiated plan amendment could be very challenging, if not impossible, regardless of what structure Plum Creek chooses to create for the homeowners association and what kind of assignments it wishes to make with respect to its successors. And we wanted to highlight to the commission that because of that, it should proceed based on the assumption that this plan cannot be amended. But we are not making any specific recommendations as to how Plum Creek should address the issue. We do feel that it is in their interest to look at this very carefully and to come up with a mechanism that satisfies their needs in the future, should they wish to approach the commission for a plan amendment.
Are you
The one thing that I also want to highlight is on the bottom of page 120 in the last row of the table, we are recommending that whatever approach Plum Creek chooses here, that description of a detailed description of those assignment provisions be presented to the commission for its review and approval.
No comments, questions? Would this be, I guess the only question thing I'd written is this something we'd expect to be done at the time of the potential approval of a plan or at some subsequent?
I would expect that this would need to be done as part of the implementation phase of of the concept plan if the commission goes there.
Okay. Moving on, I guess the concepts, the pocket part, we've some parts of that we've talked about, and I guess we have some more to talk about through the balance of this. And this last item on the Roach property. Have we talked about that at this point? Are we clear on that?
I think we've haven't we generally agreed,
right?
Or moving towards some consensus here that's appropriate is to drop the Roach. Well, to keep them in the plan, but not.
Right. I think that's true. I just, you know, this had to do with the amendment, ability to amend the.
This would follow.
Right. So I just wanted to make sure we've taken care of it. That's all. Thanks.
If I could make a general point on our thinking here. To the best of our abilities, I think it's fair to say that Jerry, Aga, Evan, and I have thought long and hard about how important is this amendment issue? What role will amendment play? How much stock should the commission place in it? And I would invite the three of them to correct me, but I think it's fair to summarize our thinking as it is highly unpredictable whether this plan can in practicality be amended and how. And therefore, and that's not necessarily anything wrong with it, because there are distinct advantages to the commission of not having a plan that can be amended willy-nilly. So I'm just trying to make as much a factual observation as we can. And therefore, and it may be that the approach Plum Creek proposes of either retaining amendment rights as long as they want to will work very well, or it may not. It may be that the approach they are alternatively proposing of assigning out certain rights to more of a parliamentary system will work very well or not. I think it is beyond your dedicated staff, consultant, counsel's ability to know the answer to that. And therefore, our approach has been that for things that we believe strongly should not be part of this unknown process, e.g. the Roaches, to deal with it like that, and for issues that we're certain of, as much as we can be with any foresight, need to be in it, we do that. And then within the terms of the document to allow flexibility without having to go through a formalistic concept plan amendment process. And that's really the thinking behind what you see, at least from my point of view, in the last couple of pages. So things that shouldn't be part of the amendment process, that don't have any place in it because they don't have really, it's apples and oranges, get them out. Get it as right as you can. Build flexibility into it through the subdivision approval process, through the long-term development iteration process where there can be a dialogue back and forth. And that's about as best as you can do. That's not necessarily a good answer or a bad answer. It's just trying to reflect what our thinking is. Jerry, I don't know whether you want to add anything to that or...
In theory, the concept plan can be amended very easily, but it requires the consent of the landowner, and that's a big if. So you have absolutely no assurance that you can amend it, and we just want you to go into this with your eyes wide open on that. Don't count on your ability to come back and amend this because it may not be possible.
I appreciate that. I think that what we're doing, and I think the applicant here has pointed out that we're getting the assurances of our end of the deal up front. Theirs, while we hope we're giving assurances through the process we set forth for subdivision and resort review in the future, the result of those review processes are by no means certain at this point. So, I mean, I think that we strike the deal, we strike the deal. We have to, I think there's a certain ethical integrity involved here, not just a matter of law, if that's the issue. But, and also, I think the amending this plan is it's becoming, for me personally, as it's coming together, it's a whole. And to tinker with one part of it, in my view, would almost necessarily raise issues with regard to another part of it. It could be extremely complex. And I'm concerned about that. However, I'm just wondering if, I mean, we hopefully we've done our homework and you people have done the appropriate analyses and this plan can be implemented. But if we all of a sudden woke up the day after this plan was submitted and approved and found out that there was some major issue that either inhibited its implementation or led to an implementation in a way that nobody anticipated, I mean, I think there's got to be some, rather than have no plan, there's got to be something there. Ron suggests building in some flexibility in the plan. Sounds nice. I'm a little concerned about that, given that I view this as sort of a holistic.
Well, when I appreciate it, but when I say flexibility, I think there's just inherent flexibility in the process. Well, when a long-term development plan comes in, that has four elements to meet.
What I'm saying is I appreciate that, and I think we ought to strive for that, but I'm just saying for myself there would be a caution in doing that. So I guess what I'm saying is I think there's got to be some way that if the whole thing isn't going to work and it serves as a detriment to everybody, we need to be able to go back in and amend this. It should be very difficult to do. I think the presumption should be against that for a number of reasons that I've expressed. So, I mean,
I think that's what de facto commissioner you have in the provision that's been proposed.
Yeah, that's why I think this. Yeah. Let them propose, the landowner propose an amendment process, or
and,
not.
And
but
there
I
has
hope.
To be there has to be mutual agreement between
right.
the commission
right.
and the landowner or a group of landowners right. that are assembled into a single vote.
And how that's done.
Again, how it's done is proposed. Plum Creek has made a proposal. These are our recommendations for it.
Okay. All right.
The only thing that's uncertain about how it's done is how Plum Creek may assign its rights
right.
to consent to amendment.
Right. And I remember there was some testimony about that and cross-examination with regard to that
right.
on the record that I think pointed out the potential complexity here.
Right.
So I think your admonition that you know, don't think this is going to be easy. But I think I've stated my concern.
You know, it just occurs to me that this is sort of a two-way street. I mean, Plum Creek may find out, you know, at some point that there is something that they would want to have amended, and they come to the commission and seek the commission's. I mean, it actually could work both ways. Anyway, so there might be, you know, some room for negotiation.
I think, though, that what I was referring to is the fact, and I think this is what Jerry and Ron were alluding to, is that the assignment here, I mean, if you've got homeowners associations all around the place and you've got, you know, you've disaggregated some of the easement territory, you're going to have, you could potentially have many, many landowners that would have to consent.
Which may be a reason not to have many landowners
from Plum Creek's perspective.
I think that Plum Creek is in the best position to propose a mechanism for how that consent would be aggregated. Isn't that what we're saying?
Yes, here? And Plum Creek is also, I can't pull immediately where it's in the record. Plum Creek, it's my understanding that their intent is to retain this amendment right even if they sell off lands for as long as they think it's appropriate to keep control of their interests. So,
and I hope I don't sound offensive, but the testimony that was presented, the proposal that was presented initially by Plum Creek, subject to the hearing, and in the complexity of that, it appeared to me that that was kind of thrown together at the last minute. And this might be an opportunity to go back and really think that through.
Yeah, I think in fairness to Plum Creek, they didn't make a proposal. Mr. Kraft and Hempelman were responding to questions that I was asking, so I can take the blame on what happens when you start selling off to other landowners and you don't have a singular landowner. And they said one way this could be solved is as it is addressed in other places. And they subsequently filed material which suggested some of those provisions in several other places, not exactly on all fours, an example, but so they weren't necessarily proposing a change. They were proposing how one way it could be addressed, and that's where it was.
I stand corrected. I think you're accurate.
Okay. One way or the other, we'll hear about amendments anyway. Can we move on to the CCR portion?